Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this afternoon is O'Keefe against Wisconsin Club for Growth.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Russell?
That's correct, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Joseph Russell. I represent the John Doe Special Prosecutor, Fran Schmitz, in these consolidated appeals. I will be addressing qualified immunity and the preliminary injunction. My colleague, Mr. Lieb, will follow with the preliminary injunction and prosecutorial immunity, and my colleague Mr. Fiedler will follow with abstention. Defendants in this case are career prosecutors and investigators that are now being sued for personal damages for fulfilling their oaths of office and furthering state criminal proceedings, namely
Who makes the decision as to whether to use the John Doe process or the grand jury? Is that purely that of the prosecutor?
I'm sorry, the John Doe proceedings are commenced by a John Doe judge, and then the...
So the judge commences the proceeding without any provocation from the prosecutors?
The John Does are petitioned for, in this case...
By whom?
By district attorneys.
By the prosecutor?
Yes, correct.
So the prosecutor makes the decision to use the John Doe process?
That's correct. He submits an affidavit and supporting exhibits to the John Doe or to the circuit court of the county in which the claimed of activity occurred.
Who then makes the designation of the John Doe judge?
The chief judge of the circuit court.
Yes.
So in this case, the Milwaukee County Circuit Court, the chief judge, assigned that petition that was filed by the district attorney's office here in Milwaukee or in Milwaukee County, and that chief judge then assigned it to, in this case, the John Doe judge, a Wisconsin state judge, Barbara Kluka, who then appointed, in this case...
Are more criminal cases investigated and prosecuted under the John Doe or the grand jury?
I believe that it's more commonplace to use the John Doe procedure because it's more efficient, it's less expensive,
We can eliminate the judge, too, and just put the prosecutor in charge. It'd even be cheaper, but go ahead.
The John Doe judge, upon reviewing the petition, and in this case there are five district attorneys of both parties that found a reasonable belief that a crime or crimes had been committed in the counties in which they
were
elected.
Where did they acquire the knowledge for this reasonable belief?
I'm sorry.
Where do they acquire this knowledge? Does somebody bring it to their attention, or do they wander out themselves?
The petitions were supported by an affidavit or affidavits that were compiled by a special investigator.
Who appoints that as special investigator?
The special investigator is, in this case, there are multiple special investigators.
In general, how does the John Doe start when somebody brings information to the prosecutor? And who is it?
Either a citizen of Wisconsin can file a John Doe complaint, or the district attorney himself can file a petition to start a John Doe.
In each case, is that filed before a judge or before the prosecutor?
It's filed with the county circuit court in which that DA is elected.
So citizens are on notice that they can wander into the circuit judge and ask for...
Yes. Any citizen who thinks they have a reasonable belief a crime has been committed can file a John Doe petition in their county circuit court.
Does it get crowded there? I mean, is it an unusual thing?
I believe the numbers have been in the thousands about these John Doe investigations that have been commenced. I think they're popular because they're efficient and they provide more
popular
procedural safeguards to the witnesses.
They're popular because they're available, you mean?
That's true, but unlike the grand jury, John Doe affords witnesses counsel to be present, provides greater procedural safeguards, due process safeguards to the witnesses who are subpoenaed in front of the John Doe judge. And based on the petitions of the John that are filed by, in this case, five different district attorneys, the John Doe judge independently finds if there's reasonable belief that a crime or crimes have been committed. In this case, Judge Kluka, in each case, five different counties, determined that campaign finance crimes had been committed. And the particular crime that had been committed, reasonable belief that a crime
had
been committed.
She didn't conclude that they'd been committed. She thought, if I'm understanding the process right, which I may not be, it's an unusual process, that there was enough to go forward with an investigation. Is that
each order? She issued five different orders commencing five different investigations in these five different counties, and in each order she found reasonable belief that a crime or crimes had been committed in that county based on the information that she received from the district attorneys.
And is the information in these affidavits part of what has been sealed in this case?
That's correct. There are several voluminous affidavits with exhibits attached that detail the activities that the district attorneys had determined or had a reasonable belief represented or indicated that crimes had been committed. And those are the documents that this court has maintained under seal, having been received from the district court. The crime at issue is coordinated issue advocacy, and the district court in unprecedented rulings denied defendants qualified immunity.
But before we get into that, one more question about the state of things in Wisconsin. What is the state of the current John Doe investigation? The judge, I gather, has quashed the subpoena to which the plaintiffs principally objected. That, I understand, is on appeal. Are there any other pending proceedings?
The John Doe was halted based on the motion to quash on January 10th by the John Doe judge. That ruling has been petitioned, my client, the special prosecutor, petitioned for writ or filed a supervisory writ and a writ for mandamus with the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. That's been kicked up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
What in Wisconsin does the phrase kicked up to mean precisely?
I'm sorry.
We have some very strange Wisconsin proceedings.
When a petition for a supervisory writ has been filed, which is the normal way to appeal a ruling of a John Doe judge.
And that was filed in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals.
That was filed in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals by the special prosecutor. And it was before the Wisconsin Court of Appeals when the unnamed interveners filed a motion to bypass the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, which is the procedural mechanism.
Did they file that motion in the Wisconsin Supreme Court?
That's correct. They file it both in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals and the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and pending any ruling by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, it's no longer acted upon by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals.
What do you mean,
Appeals?
Pending any ruling? Did the Supreme Court accept this transfer?
The petition is pending. It hasn't acted on the petition.
All right. So technically, this is in the Court of Appeals, and there is a pending request in the Supreme Court of Wisconsin to remove it from the State Court of Appeals.
Correct. But the Wisconsin Court of Appeals cannot act on the petition itself, right?
And that's also a peculiarity of Wisconsin law, that the Court of Appeals is prohibited from acting while a request is pending?
Under the appellate statutes of the state of Wisconsin, that's
okay.
My understanding.
We just need to understand exactly what's going on.
Right.
Thank you.
And then there's an original action that was filed regarding the John Doe proceedings. That's also in front of the Supreme Court of Wisconsin.
So it has, at the moment, a request and also an original action, both pending.
Correct. A petition for original action that is still pending.
Another
that hasn't been acted
okay.
upon. And then there's a ruling that was made by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals on January 30th, 2014, that said that the John Doe proceedings were legitimate, that the John Doe judge's appointment of the special prosecutor was legitimate, and which also legitimized the secrecy orders that the John Doe judge issued.
Did it issue that order before the petition to transfer the proceedings to the Supreme Court of Wisconsin?
It issued it on January 30th. The petition for supervisory writ filed by the special prosecutor was filed on February 21st, 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And then the plaintiffs filed their lawsuit, and in unprecedented rulings, the defendants were denied their immunities based on a ruling that the legal theory underlying the John Doe proceedings was unconstitutional. And in doing so, equated the state criminal proceedings with the gulag and the guillotine.
So before you sit down, I don't want to get into wild rhetoric on the part of any party here, but you are going to discuss qualified immunity. And the one question that your opponents have raised is whether you somehow have forfeited your entitlement to discuss whether this is a clearly established rule.
And we have not forfeited. Procedurally, each defendant raised the qualified immunity defense in their motions to dismiss. They raised it on appeal, and the right, which is being questioned here, the clearly established right that was allegedly violated, is the right to be free of government regulation for secret coordinated issue advocacy. That right doesn't exist. It's not clearly established, and there's no forfeiture because the district court incorrectly framed the constitutional right at issue.
Well, I thought too. Didn't you argue in your reply brief that not only had it been raised, albeit a bit briefly, but there had been filings from both sides on this point, and the district court was aware the issue was there.
That's correct. Each defendant raised in multiple pages and separately headed sections. The plaintiffs filed a response that had about 15 pages detailing why qualified immunity wasn't appropriate at the motion to dismiss phase, and in doing so also said that the right was clearly established.
On the other side, yeah, right, I understand.
Correct.
Well, if you would like to stick with your plan of argument, I believe that your time has expired.
If I just say the coordinated issue advocacy, which the district court said was a clearly established right, it doesn't exist. The Supreme Court, since Buckley v. Vallejo in 1976, has determined that coordinated expenditures can be regulated as contributions. They are, in fact, disguised contributions, hidden contributions. For that reason, they can be regulated and subject to the contribution limits and disclosure requirements of contributions. The district court failed to look at these cases as coordinated expenditures. They looked, and the plaintiffs rely on the same cases. Those cases are about independent expenditures. When you have a case of coordinated expenditures, you apply a different standard of review, a closely drawn standard of review, and that's to prevent the quid pro quo corruption, the heightened risk of quid pro quo corruption and its appearance in the contribution mode of regulation. If I may, I'll relinquish the lectern to
please,
Mr.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Samuel Lieb. I'm from the firm of Wilson, Elser, Moskowitz, Edelman, and Dicker, and I have the privilege of representing John Chisholm, the District Attorney of Milwaukee, Bruce Landgraf, and David Robles, members of the District Attorney's Office. I'd like to commence by referencing this court's opinion in Redwood versus Dobson, a 2007 case. My clients, along with the other defendants, acted as they conceived the public interest to require. They had no reason to do any favors, and they received nothing in return except this lawsuit. This was in return for their official actions. No prosecutor handles a case in an isolation tank. That's what this court wrote. Discussions with victims, witnesses, and police are common. If these ordinary acts amount to a violation of the Constitution, then immunities will be worthless, and both
that
witnesses.
Counsel, you're certainly not responding to what the district court wrote in this case. District court thought that no, the First Amendment does not allow regulation of coordinated expenditures. Now, if that's right, one might think that it doesn't matter what's in the prosecutor's heads. Don't we need to figure out, or don't we need to address the grounds on which this case was decided in the district court?
I would submit to the court that the district court's ruling on the motion to dismiss, if that's what the court refers to as opposed to the preliminary injunction, the motion to dismiss really revolves around the denial of absolute immunity. That's the issue that I'm here to address. And absolute immunity has been granted by this court in Harris versus Harvey It is the only published opinion dealing.
Well, let's be a little more precise. One of the things, as I understand it, that the district court was concerned about was whether the prosecutors in this particular set of circumstances were acting in an investigatory capacity, in which case the absolute immunity doesn't apply, or whether they were kind of an Imbler against Pacman sort of sense, acting in a quasi-judicial capacity. And there are cases, the Supreme Court has emphasized that this is a functional distinction. So for prosecutors, it really depends what you're doing, and maybe you could dig into that a bit.
Yes, Your Honor, and Imbler and Buckley all look to the functional test. They clearly don't allow absolute immunity for a prosecutor. They allow it for the function. I would acknowledge that. And there are those cases that have made reference to absolute immunity does not attach before probable cause attaches.
Right. So what do we do with these John Doe proceedings? Or for that matter, what would you do if it were a grand jury, if a prosecutor were going before a grand jury, getting a subpoena, doing something in that connection?
Well, and the court has affixed absolute immunity to the grand jury proceeding. And when you look at the quality of the judicial oversight of a John Doe proceeding, it exceeds that of a grand jury. There is a judge, as my colleague noted. It starts with an application by Judge Kremers in Milwaukee County, the chief judge, who had to ascertain whether or not it was a proper subject matter for a John Doe proceeding. That there has to be a legitimate belief that
in a grand jury proceeding, the judge does have a lot to say when they report to the grand jury. He can accept the report or reject it. So there is oversight. They swear him in. They pick him.
The grand jury.
Yeah.
The members of the grand jury.
Yeah.
But judge, each time that a subpoena or a search warrant
right.
or any other motion practice took place, there was always a judge. Judge Kluka, Judge Nettesheim, Judge Peterson, which it should be noted, this case all revolves around a single subpoena that was issued.
I'm suggesting to you that any witness be called before a grand jury can go before the chief judge with his lawyer to complain about the process itself.
Well, and that may be a reality.
So there is, but the reality is what you said was that the grand jury kind of operates free-floating. It does not. It operates under the direction of both the prosecutor, who is their attorney, and the judge who swears them in and disposes of all problems that occur before it.
Well, the distinction I would draw, Judge, is that there is a persistence in a John Doe proceeding that doesn't exist in a grand jury, and by that I mean...
The judge is all by himself. He does it alone. He doesn't worry about the 23 people that might be involved with the grand jury.
He's there all the time,
and no
subpoena can issue, no search warrant can issue, but upon probable cause,
right.
ascertained
right.
each.
Well,
each
I mean,
time.
It doesn't hurt you to agree with Judge Bauer and say that they are roughly the same thing. Seems to me that seems to be the point that maybe you were going toward.
And Your Honor, at a minimum, I would say they're equivalent, but I think there are additional safeguards with the John Doe that a grand jury wouldn't have.
It seems to me it's a difference between a one-man grand jury and a 23-man grand jury. Well,
except to the extent that the judge, and Wisconsin case law has spoken to this issue, that the judge applies their knowledge, learning, training, and they truly supervise.
Such as it might be or might not be, but the point is I agree that it's Wisconsin law, and I'm not fighting that. I'm suggesting I'd like to know how it works, but not to suggest that John Doe is far better than the grand jury because there's only one judge involved.
We are agnostic on that, I assure you.
Yeah. And this court is the only court that has issued an opinion regarding the John Doe, and I realize this court did not have an elaborate discussion in Harris versus Harvey about the nature of the John Doe. It was essentially a given that the John Doe attached to absolute immunity.
So the critical question, I guess the issue that you are here to discuss with us, though, is still getting back to that functional line that the Supreme Court of the United States draws, whether this is one of those situations that every time the prosecutor walks in and has some interaction with the John Doe process, is it your argument that it's always absolute immunity, or is it sometimes, depending on what the judge what the prosecutor is seeking? I assume the prosecutor must be the one going and saying, I'd like to have a subpoena issued to A.
Yes, and then the judge has to make a probable cause determination.
The judge will decide, and as we were and saying, we're
proceed.
Talking about this one subpoena here in this instance.
And part of the issue, Your Honor, is whether or not they're advocating on behalf of the state when they do that. That's part of the functional test, and that's the reality. They appear before the John Doe judge advocating on behalf of the state. It is intimately related to the judicial proceedings, which has been the standard that's been set forth in Buckley and the other cases. It is intimately related to the judicial proceedings in part because it is, in fact, presided over by a judge throughout the process. And when we look at the absolute immunity in this case and looking at the case law, These defendants are entitled, appellants are entitled to absolute immunity. I think the case law makes it clear, and I think that's something that they're entitled to. I would like to comment in the remainder of my time regarding the preliminary injunction. I was not intending to comment on the likelihood of success. Mr. Russell was going to handle that issue. But this is an issue that has come before the court. Every step of the way, this was reviewed and evaluated by multiple judges, by the GAB and its judges appointed by the governor of the state.
Could I ask you a question? This is just a procedural clarification. We were speaking earlier about what's going on in the Wisconsin courts, and I have the impression that there are many tracks going on in this case, and so we know that the district court here issued a preliminary injunction against any further proceeding with the John Doe investigation here, whatever I'm supposed to call it, the John Doe process. But there's am I correct that the Wisconsin courts have also enjoined it, or somehow it's halted because of that, too, as a matter of comedy?
Well, the third in line of John Doe judges appointed by
Judge Peterson.
Judge Peterson. Quash the subpoena.
He quashed the subpoena, and nothing else is. I mean, I'm just wondering whether by this point in time there's an independent and parallel state law stay in effect, if you will, against the proceedings, or whether it's just the federal law one.
Well, I think to the extent, I don't know if it's a de facto stay to the extent, and this is the judicial quality of the John Doe proceeding, that they went into court to quash the subpoena. The subpoena was quashed, and then it went to the appellate level. All the procedural safeguards that one looks for in Houston versus Partee, that was.
But what I'm curious about is, suppose Judge Peterson decided to issue another subpoena tomorrow. He couldn't do that consistently with the district court's injunction here. Is there a Wisconsin injunction that says to the John Doe judge, don't issue any more subpoenas for the time being?
You know, Your Honor, I don't know if I can speak to whether the appellate court has issued a stay or it's an automatic stay because of the nature of the John Doe and how this cycles up. I really can't say in that regard.
That's
I would like to just comment briefly about the abstention has been argued, and the 1983 action, which is a personal action, is a damage action. I'm requesting that this court issue its opinion that there is absolute immunity on the 1983 action. I understand we've also moved for abstention, but this is a matter of original jurisdiction with this court, a 1983 action. This court is familiar and has...
There's certainly no original jurisdiction in this court.
No, I meant in the federal district court, Your Honor. In the federal court, the 1983 action.
It's its own action in the federal court. We're here on appeal from a denial of a preliminary injunction, among other things. We understand that if what you're getting at is you're concerned that abstention would get you only as far as injunctive relief and your clients would like a statement that there's immunity, we understand that from the briefs that that's what your clients have asked for.
Okay. And lastly, just to finish my presentation, on the preliminary injunction, the procedural and substantive irregularities, I'm not going to inventory them. They're in our briefs. as to what occurred at the district court. The court is well aware of the history. As we stand currently, if this court should evaluate the issue of coordinated issue advocacy and determine that it's going to make some kind of ruling, I would request the court please vacate in its entirety the district court's basis for the ruling. However this court gets to that issue, if it perceives it needs to, this district court ruling has left a considerable stain, and we do not wish to have that.
What are you asking for concretely? You want us to issue a writ of erasure?
Well,
tell the district court it has to say something else? When we review a case on appeal, we will issue our own opinion. But we don't go about erasing district court opinions. That seems to be what you want us to do.
Well, what I was thinking, Your Honor, is the vacation of that opinion.
Well, that would automatically happen.
We do not
happen.
Vacate opinions. We review judgments.
In vacating the judgment, the request that we have, because I assume one consideration of the court would be to remand. We have complained of not getting a hearing, not having the procedural safeguards. I would request that the preliminary injunction be dismissed, and be dismissed for all the reasons we set forth in our reply brief, and that that judgment be vacated in whole. And that would be my request regarding relief, Your Honor.
All right. If you want to save a second for rebuttal, I would advise you to do so.
Thank you.
And Mr. Fiedler?
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'm Patrick Fiedler, attorney for Defendant Dean Nickel. I'm addressing the district court's decision not to abstain under Younger. The district court should have done so because a John Doe proceeding is a quasi-criminal one initiated by the state in its sovereign capacity to investigate criminal activity. I want to address first the Sprint Communications case issued
by
the...
Does your position depend on abstention, or are you arguing more broadly that an injunction is not an appropriate equitable remedy in a case like this?
I'm arguing primarily based upon abstention, but...
Why? Abstention matters when an injunction would be an appropriate equitable remedy, but a court under Younger just can't even consider the case. A more modest position might be whether or not the court can consider the case. An injunction is not an appropriate equitable remedy because the state court proceedings are available to address these very questions. Are you making such an argument?
Yes, Your Honor. The it's already been mentioned by co-counsel as it relates to pending court proceedings in the state venue where this has been raised, and I think that this is an appropriate situation under Younger for the federal district court to abstain.
As I say, abstention is a different question from what equity would require. I mean, I'm thinking now about what the Supreme Court said in Mitchum against Foster about the relation between normal principles of equity and the Anti-Injunction Act, 28 U.S.C. 2283.
So you'll remember from Mitchum against Foster that 1983 is, in appropriate circumstances, an expressly authorized exception under the Anti-Injunction Act, but also principles of equity, including whether there's an adequate remedy at law, including whether there's an adequate remedy in the state courts, don't just disappear because there's a 1983 case. They are always there.
Well, certainly as it relates to the question of whether or not the subpoena should have been quashed by Judge Peterson, that is on track to be decided by a state court. I realize that plaintiffs...
Is there any value added for the federal court to poke its head in on that one?
I would say no, Your Honor.
So perhaps there's an adequate remedy at law. I mean, I think Judge Easterbrook is just trying to get you to look at a hierarchy of arguments. You don't have to jump all the way to the last one in the line if there are others that would also be pertinent.
All right. Well, in that regard, I feel that it would be appropriate here for this court to find that abstention would apply to
the injunction. Or that there's an adequate remedy, right?
There's an adequate remedy at law.
The bottom line would be about the same, although I think there might be an interesting question, because you're talking about injunctions at this point. As your opponents have pointed out, there are requests for money damages as well in
Correct.
This case.
Mm-hmm. And that's why Mr. Lieb brought up the question of immunity here, because one of the things that the court could do is determine, for instance, that abstention would be appropriate here, that as it relates to the claim brought against the defendants in their personal capacity, that should be stayed pending the outcome of the state proceeding. But we would argue in addition to that, that the this case is ripe for this court to decide that immunity does apply, thus taking away the personal claims.
The personal damage claims.
Personal capacity
claims.
Which is
what qualified immunity or the absolute immunity might
Correct.
All right, so we will indulge you at this moment and let you offer a few comments about Younger, understanding the qualifications that Judge Easterbrook has put on the table. One of the things your opponents suggest is, yes, of course, Younger applies when a federal court is being asked to interfere with an ongoing state court proceeding, and there are a number of questions, like whether one would have the opportunity to raise the arguments in question before the state courts. And there's also a question of bad faith, which they have argued. So if you'd like to talk about any of those things.
All right. Well, then very quickly in that regard, this is a situation where Younger should apply. The actions commenced by the state in its sovereign capacity. It's initiated to sanction the federal plaintiff for some wrongful act. And there are this is a situation where the John Doe proceeding is very much analogous to the grand jury type of proceeding. As far as bad faith, what we're back to is, first of all, the Collins case issued by this court indicates that conclusory allegations of bad faith don't carry the day. Rather, you have to have specific allegations of bad faith and a showing that there's a targeting to interfere with the exercise of constitutional rights. I see that my time is up.
Thank All right. you. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Fiedler. Mr. Delaquil, is that something close to the right pronunciation?
Very close, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, Your Honors. My name is Mark Delaquil, and I represent the plaintiffs' appellees. I'd like to respond to four questions that the court raised during my colleague's presentation earlier. First point is our qualified immunity forfeiture argument. We are not arguing that the defendants failed to raise a qualified immunity defense as an affirmative defense in this case. We are arguing that defendants Schmitz and Nickel failed to raise the argument that they are entitled to qualified immunity because there's no clearly established right to coordinate issue advocacy. They didn't raise that in their briefs below. In the reply brief, Mr. Schmitz apparently appended a pleading in a different court that related to the issue, but we don't think that's sufficient to preserve it in this court.
I'm interested because, you know, once you've raised qualified immunity, it's actually quite clear under a whole range of Supreme Court cases from Barons against Pelletier on through Pearson against Callahan and quite a bit in between. That there are two aspects to it, you know, if the facts show a violation of a protected right, and is that clearly established? And so I'm not sure how much beyond saying we're asserting qualified immunity is necessary.
I think it's not an issue of raising the defense so much as it is an issue of argument forfeiture. There's a general principle of law that an argument not raised in the district court can't be presented for the first time in the court of appeals.
But I guess the question is, what's an argument? I mean, certainly the argument, had they failed to say we're entitled to qualified immunity, I would be completely on board with you. You know, you could forfeit that kind of argument, and that would be their tough luck. But they did say qualified immunity, so now we're at a somewhat more granular level.
We are, Your Honor, and you know the circuit's case law on this point, the general case law on forfeiture, is that the argument does need to be presented in the district court with some specificity. A general argument simply won't do. Flagging the issue simply won't do.
Assuming the issue is before us, do you think there is no qualified immunity, and why?
We think there's no qualified immunity. First, we think that the defendants have misstated the right at issue. The right at issue in this case is our client's right to be free from a criminal investigation prompted in retaliation for their exercise of their First Amendment rights.
But that's too broad. I mean, the district court talked about that, and the Supreme Court has begged us in cases including Anderson against Creighton and many others not to say people have a right to First Amendment expression or a right to due process. To be quite honest, just watching the field of campaign funding regulation in recent years, whether it's the Supreme Court's cases or our cases up to and including Barland too, this is an area in tremendous flux. What's clearly established here?
We think, in light of the discussion in Reichel versus the Reichel case in the Supreme Court and the Hartman v. Moore case, that at the very least, a criminal investigation conducted without probable cause and motivated for retaliation for First Amendment rights
that
is clearly established.
You're just back to the high level of generality. The question I have, which I think is similar to the Chief Judge's question, is what case are you relying on that makes it concrete that there cannot be legal regulation of coordinated contributions and expenditures between nominally independent groups and political campaigns?
Our two best cases are, first, Wisconsin Right to Life, the 2007 Supreme Court case.
Hey, that doesn't say that. What's your other one?
It's the Madigan case that this court decided in 2012 vis-a-vis Illinois. And where that applies specifically is in the context of whether coordination can occur where an independent group has made no expenditures related to a specific candidate. In that case, the court clearly stated the coordination rule as being issue advocacy expenditures, which under Illinois law are effectively express advocacy due to the fact that that's a new campaign finance statute, must relate to the candidate in question. That's how every court, to my knowledge, in our thorough review of the case law, has viewed the issue. So that would be a separate and independent grounds if the issue is framed very narrowly. As a 2012 case, it would certainly apply to any conduct after 2012.
So Madigan is your best case, you're going to say?
Yes. The second issue I'd like to address was prosecutorial immunity. And as I understood your question...
Although, of course, Madigan upholds the Illinois campaign finance laws with this definition. So it's
Madigan
hard to
does.
Say that Madigan is a good case for saying that they're illegal.
But as the Madigan court noted, Illinois campaign finance law, in the relevant respect, reaches only express advocacy or its functional equivalent. And we don't contest that express advocacy or its functional equivalent can be restricted consistent with the Constitution if coordinated.
Let me come back to Judge Wood's observation. I'm trying to think back to what that case is. And of course, as she said, we sustained the state law. You seem to be saying that when a federal court holds that a state campaign finance law is valid, that it is simultaneously holding that no other law could possibly be valid?
What I'm referring to, Your Honor, is what I...
What would be the basis for that equation?
The basis would be this court's clear statement identifying that coordination applies vis-a-vis expenditures made with the candidate the group has allegedly coordinated with.
Well, but that's Judge Easterbrook's question. The language... This may be some of the language you're thinking of. The Illinois laws treat as a contribution an electioneering communication made in concert or cooperation with the candidate, a political committee, or any of their agents. And so, you know, you say that that's okay, but the negative inference from that would every state has to do the same thing Illinois does?
2 points, Your Honor.
That's a shocking proposition.
Well, I suppose we could hope not, but 2 points, Your Honor. First, I believe that quote goes on to continue to for that candidate's campaign.
Right. And so when Illinois said that, you know, the Center for Individual Freedom case says, okay, you know, we'll let Illinois say that. But does that mean that that sets a ceiling and a floor for Wisconsin or anyone else?
That's our position, Your Honor, and those are our best cases.
All right. That's
getting to the issue of prosecutorial immunity. As I understood Judge Wood's question earlier today, it was essentially, does the presentation of evidence to a judge effectively create absolute immunity? And we think the answer to that is clearly no. The defendants have argued heavily that the prevalence of the John Doe proceeding, which they liken to a grand jury, essentially means they have absolute immunity.
So could I ask you, maybe following up a bit on what Judge Bauer's been pursuing,
yes,
whether you take the position that say it's a federal prosecutor before a federal grand jury, whether such a person's actions before the grand jury fall under the cloak of absolute immunity?
And my position would be it depends. In Buckley versus Fitzsimmons, which is the Supreme Court's clearest, most recent addressing of this subject, there actually was an investigative grand jury convened. And the Supreme Court, applying its functional approach, you know, the approach that where a prosecutor acts like a prosecutor, he has immunity, and where he acts like an investigator, he does not, said, based on the facts and circumstances, that this was really an investigative grand jury, that the purpose was not an immediate return of an indictment against a particular person, but was more a what-are-the-facts situation. And in that
a great number of grand juries are used for that purpose. It's to get rid of cases that shouldn't be in the system, as well as to indict people who should be in the system.
I agree that
But there are investigatory problems with every grand jury investigation.
Absolutely, and that's why it's so important to look to what is actually happening and what is the prosecutor actually
doing. Would you have to assume that the prosecutor has not a indictment in mind, or he does not propose the criminal charge, that he's just fishing around hoping to stumble onto something?
Not in the case of a John Doe proceeding, certainly, Your Honor. A John Doe proceeding does not indend with an indictment.
But to back up to the grand jury, I mean, certainly the Supreme Court has drawn a functional line, and so if the police are calling up the prosecutor and saying, you know, hey, we'd like to, you know, get a search warrant for this, would you mind taking a look at the affidavit to see if that's going to be enough? The Supreme Court said, look, you're acting exactly the way the police act. You get only qualified immunity in that situation. By the time the police don't wander into a grand jury and start presenting witnesses. That's the prosecutor's job. So I think the role is at least different, and I'm not sure Buckley went quite as far as you're saying.
Well, even if there were immunity in front of the grand jury, excuse me, the John Doe, for something like an attorney's presentment of argument in open court, we allege that investigatory acts took place outside the context of any grand jury investigation, including through a surreptitious public records request, through interviews by the prosecutors with willing witnesses, and other activities that are clearly investigative. And so at the collateral order appeal stage, dismissal on absolute immunity would be, in our view, inappropriate.
You will concede that the possibility of investigating the crime involves also digging in and asking questions that you don't know the answer to?
Absolutely. I would certainly concede
that.
So
that's an investigatory problem, not a prosecutorial problem. I'm looking to see if you did something wrong or you could tell me about something that was done wrong. That's investigation.
Yes, Your Honor.
And would you have absolute immunity for that?
No.
Why not?
because when the prosecutor is acting as an investigator, absolute immunity does not attach under Buckley.
So if I bring in a secretary to somebody who I think is stealing money, give her immunity, or him, and asked him to tell me what happened. Am I investigating, or am I presenting evidence, or withdrawing, getting evidence on it?
Your Honor, if what the prosecutor is doing is attempting to cut a deal, I think that's a
no,
fair...
No, not cut a deal, to get information that he has that I want.
After
am I investigating, or am I in the process of prosecuting?
The line drawn there in Buckley versus Fitzsimmons is, as I understand it, is... If the prosecutor hasn't made the decision to seek an indictment based on probable cause, that counts as investigative activity. And in Whitlock versus Breugemann,
oh,
the court left a...
It's just what the prosecutor intends to do?
I think it's
Is he seeking an indictment, or is he investigating for other purposes? That's a difference.
I would say that it's not intent-based, but based on an objective characterization of what the prosecutor's done. But that raises another issue that I mentioned briefly. We're at the 12B6 motion to dismiss stage.
Yeah.
We know, we've done our best to know the meets and bounds of exactly what's occurred, but there's been a secrecy order on the John Doe proceeding. We don't know anything. And some of these issues are simply discovery issues that need to be addressed in that context.
So you don't take a full position on qualified immunity until you know more facts?
Absolute prosecutorial immunity. That's right. We think factual development would benefit this issue, and that the prosecutors could assert summary judgment motions after appropriate discovery, and there's more information on what occurred.
So since you've talked about abuses that you fear are going on in this proceeding, I have to ask you one of the questions that bothers me most about this case, which is why a month after the John Doe judge, Judge Peterson, quashed the subpoena, you filed this lawsuit and you took the position that the Wisconsin courts, its judicial system as a whole, is incapable of solving the problems that you believe to be there. I don't know if they're there or not. I mean, what do I know? But Wisconsin has a court system, and there appear to be procedures that are available to people.
They do, and I think this also relates to Judge Easterbrook's inquiry on equity, and why does equity demand an injunction here? First, the John Doe judge did quash a subpoena to the Wisconsin Club for Growth. Excuse me, strike that, to Mr. O'Keefe.
Oh, it was Mr. O'Keefe.
To Mr. O'Keefe. It is Mr. O'Keefe. But the Wisconsin court system has done nothing about the fact that the investigators and the defendants have records obtained from our vendors, from other associates of the Club for Growth. They have our bank records. They
but
have our email records.
You can address that, I would think. And if the Wisconsin courts, in reviewing the subpoena that's been quashed, certainly Mr. O'Keefe is raising the questions that interest you most about the permissible scope of campaign finance regulation and issue advocacy and express advocacy and all the rest of those things. Surely they have the power to say this proceeding has to stop. And I'm just confused by your assumption that the Wisconsin courts don't seem to have that power.
Your Honor, the experience of the Club for Growth is that it's very difficult to get effective relief through the Wisconsin Supreme Court system. The Barlin II case is an excellent example of that, where the Wisconsin Supreme Court accepted an original petition on Rule 1.28, governing the definition of political purposes, and 2 years later discharged that petition with no decision, at which point groups...
What does that have to do with this investigation? All you have to do to end this investigation is persuade Judge Peterson to end this investigation. He's already quashed the main subpoena, and it does seem to me that it's not an ordinary exercise of federal jurisdiction to superintend how state trial judges are making their day-to-day decisions. But that seems to be what you're requesting.
The John Doe judge has the ability to end the John Doe proceeding. We do not believe that the John Doe judge has the ability to end the investigation. This investigation...
Well, he can't stop prosecutors from reading the newspapers, that's for sure. He can't stop them from asking friends. But, of course, you can't stop me from reading the newspapers. Are you going to ask a district judge to enjoin me from reading the newspapers and reaching my own conclusions?
Certainly not, Your Honor. But
that was the right answer.
If I did ask, I don't think I'd find a district court judge that would do it.
You don't want him to act on anything.
Actually, a bankruptcy judge in New Jersey once enjoined me from holding a hearing. You can look up in the reports what happened after that.
I think I know the end of this story. but, Your Honor, that's true. We can't shut off people from reading the newspaper. We can't shut off people from other activities.
But there's a serious point here. If the
yes.
John Doe judge were to shut down this John Doe proceeding, this would presumably be a reasoned decision on a lawful basis. And if a prosecutor almost contumaciously decided to go ahead and flout Wisconsin law, there are procedures in Wisconsin law for addressing that kind of thing. And I'm a little troubled by the chain of ifs anyway. I mean, it seems to me one assumes regularity in the state's proceedings and one assumes that prosecutors will abide by rulings. Certainly the special prosecutor, Mr. Schmitz, has no reason to do anything but abide by the orders of the courts. I don't understand why the federal courts at this micro level were to be brought in, and I'm frankly troubled by the idea of a precedent that every time somebody gets frustrated with the pace of things in a state court, when individual reputations or financial matters are at stake, they're going to come running across the street to the federal court and ask us to pick up the supervision.
May I inquire from you an opinion? Do you think it'd be possible, legally possible, if the John Doe proceedings were shut down altogether, the injunction was followed through, for the government, the Wisconsin prosecutors, to open a grand jury investigation on the same subject?
Judge Bauer, I don't know the answer to that question. But
well,
I
what do you think?
I think that it would be possible, yes. I don't
well,
think that...
So are we chasing our tail around a flagpole? I mean, we cut off one thing and they can open another. You do the same thing.
But that's our concern. Our concern is also that information that was taken during this part of the investigation could be used for other purposes. While we can't prohibit Judge Easterbrook or any other judge from reading the newspaper, it's not clear to me that we can prohibit an extraordinary writ from the strike extraordinary absent an injunction from this court or the district court preclude the investigators from looking at the bank records of ours that they've already taken and spinning off the investigation in a different manner that can be prejudicial to my clients.
But they've already had, I mean, isn't that cat out of the bag? I mean, they've had the records. We have sealing orders. I have to say, I went through both of these briefs and compared the copies under seal with the ones that were...
Hoping somebody would try and stop her from reading.
It was a fun weekend. And I'm mystified at some of the sealing. I certainly understand, and we'll get to this in the second argument, why people might have concerns about their names or their strategies or something. But boy, there's a lot of this that's questionable to me.
Well,
particularly since there's sort of an on-again, off-again interest in privacy on all sides of this case.
But, Your Honor, while this certainly will be the subject of much argument in the next case, and we believe we've asserted a consistent First Amendment privilege claim vis-a-vis certain information that includes strategies, that also includes donors of the club, material that's confidential under federal law, and that can be addressed in that proceeding.
That's fine. No problem.
I'd like to turn now briefly to the merits of the dispute as we see it on the preliminary injunction, which is the issue advocacy coordination question. Under Wisconsin right
to... But is it really? Because your brief reads as though this were Barland 3, you know, as though this were a lawsuit brought against perhaps the Government Accountability Board about the compatibility of Wisconsin's law with where the Supreme Court of the United States is going, with the First Amendment, with whatever legal standards you wish. And it isn't really. It's one step removed. It's about enjoining a prosecution by the state. And so it seems to me there's this extra fact there that makes it quite different from just a front-on attack on the Wisconsin laws, which has happened a few times, which has led to judicial decisions. It could happen again.
That's a fair characterization, Your Honor. When we filed this complaint, we filed the complaint we thought fit the facts.
But you didn't file a lawsuit, you know, a more frontal attack. If you, and believe me, I have no question about the sincerity of your belief that if it's just issue advocacy, it doesn't really matter if it's coordinated or if it's individual. You've made that clear through hundreds of pages. And this proceeding seems like a poor vehicle for establishing that proposition, since this is about, as I see it, a federalism issue. Should the federal courts step in and enjoin a state proceeding?
The federalism issue is certainly present in the case.
It's predominant in the case, don't you think?
I think,
and not simply federalism, as I've already mentioned. There is a statute, the Anti-Injunction Act, which says a court of the United States may not grant an injunction to stay proceedings in a state court. Then there are a couple of excepts. Mitchum against Foster holds that 1983 can be an except, but it says, hey, don't run with that, right? Be modest. Be careful.
Very true.
What you seem to be treating this case as the Chief said, is one in which we don't have to worry about 1983, and we don't have to worry about the limits in Mitchum against Foster. But we do, in fact, under 2283, that's where we start with the rule against enjoining or staying proceedings of a state court.
Well, we recognize the Anti-Injunction Act, and we recognize that as...
But you didn't brief it.
We didn't brief it because the because 1983 is a recognized exception.
Mitchum did not say, and from now on, just ignore it. Mitchum made it a centerpiece in any litigation like this, and it certainly hasn't been a centerpiece in your litigation strategy.
It has not, Your Honor. The centerpiece in our litigation strategy has been the violation of my client's First Amendment rights. As to Judge Wood's question about, you know, isn't there more than just a facial challenge to the statute, or strike that, an as-applied challenge to the statute, that's true. But we think the issue of constitutionality is inextricably intertwined in the question of whether there's bad faith, that the district court's decision, based on its finding on page one, that this was an investigation intended to target conservative advocacy community, combined with its ruling on the law of coordinated issue advocacy, constitutes in totality a finding of bad faith prosecution that we're likely to prevail on the merits of. The Constitution...
Everything you say just tells me that you are or should be confident that Judge Peterson will halt this inquiry once you make to him all the arguments you're making to us.
When we have made the constitutional arguments to Judge Peterson, and he did not rule on them.
Well, of course, it's such a procedural mess at the moment. Maybe once it gets tidied up a bit, Judge Peterson will feel free to move forward.
I actually have a related question. Do you concede that coordination of issue advocacy with campaign finance committees is unlawful under Wisconsin law? I thought you were denying it.
We do deny that.
Well, then let me tell you what the problem is. If what your client has done is simply not illegal under Wisconsin law at all, why should a federal court issue a constitutionally based injunction? It seems to me to get the cart ahead of the horse to enjoin an application of something that may not represent Wisconsin law at all. You know, advisory opinion leaps to mind, but normally we need, before we do something, to pin down exactly what state law is. Now, in our most recent Wisconsin campaign finance case, the Wisconsin Right to Life against Borland from earlier this year, we were able to pin everything down and then assess its constitutionality. It took some difficulty. But here, it seems, you're asking us to decide a federal constitutional issue even though you're simultaneously denying that Wisconsin law presents that constitutional issue. That gives me a serious problem.
But Your Honor, I think this question goes to the issue of Pullman abstention, which is an equitable doctrine. Pullman is a creature of equity, and it does state that a district court has discretion to abstain from deciding a federal constitutional issue where a decision of state law could avoid the need for that decision. But there's also a long line of cases holding that in First Amendment context, there is an important federal interest in deciding the case. In light of the important federal interest in deciding our client's constitutional First Amendment claims, we believe that the district court was within its discretion to hold that our right to speak and the public's right to hear that speech merited deciding the claims and refusing to abstain under Pullman. Abuse of discretion is a high standard, and in light of the First Amendment interest, we don't think it's met in this case.
Still have 60 seconds if you'd like to wrap up.
There's one sentence in the reply brief of the defendants that we think really frames the issue in this case. It's, contrary to plaintiff's claims, defendant need not justify the commencement of a state criminal proceeding by identifying evidence that demonstrates that a crime has, in fact, been committed. What this means is that the defendants are claiming the power to say you engaged in what is First Amendment protected association. We suspect because you exercised your First Amendment protected associational rights and speech rights that we can launch an investigation that proves that the process is the punishment. We think that's wrong for the reasons we've discussed in the brief. That's the choice the court has, and we respectfully request that it affirm the district court's decisions.
Thank you very much, Mr. DeLaQuille. I think you did save a bit of time, Mr. Lieb, so we will hear from you briefly.
Just very quickly. This was an investigation, a John Doe proceeding that was commenced. It was commenced consistent with every safeguard known to Wisconsin law. It was. And it would seem incongruous that prosecutors would enjoy greater immunities in a proceeding such as a grand jury proceeding as opposed to a John Doe proceeding. Certainly the safeguards remain the same in this court and other courts have held.
Now do you concede that should Judge Peterson take this up, it would be within his authority to shut down the John Doe proceeding?
I think it is within his authority, and I think although we cited case law in our reply brief regarding the scope or extent, a John Doe judge is not acting as a circuit court judge, but they do have the authority, I think, to do that.
If you did do such a thing, is it possible for the prosecutor to open a grand jury proceeding on the same subject?
Yes, but I think the distinction.
Just yes or no.
I think
you don't think they would.
Well, I think the procedure is very similar. There's.
Oh, I hear. Yeah. I have some knowledge of working with grand juries, so I understand the procedure. I just wanted to know whether you thought there was any reason why they couldn't go ahead anyway.
Can there be a greater demand for absolute immunity when what they're contesting is the theory of the prosecution. The theory that coordinated issue advocacy can be regulated.
I don't think that's what the issue is, but you go ahead.
Okay. Well, this is the genesis of this, and the problem with that is that every judge, the GAB, every member of the GAB, unanimously, you've seen the emails. You've seen the presentation of evidence that was made. Every authority, every potential for regulation of this or evaluation of this determined
okay.
The proceeding needs to go on.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lieb.
Okay. Thank
Your
you.
Time is up. All right. Well, thanks to all counsel on this case. I have a feeling we'll be seeing the same people maybe for the next case, but we will take this case under advisement.